Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Merry Christmas, Celeste Headlee.
Merry Christmas, John Hockenberry.
Yeah, holidays are so meaningful because they are an accumulation of memories, really. And I think maybe it's a good time to reflect on the way the world used to be.
Maybe when things were a little easier and the economy was a little better.
Well, not quite. We're going to look back on a Christmas that had a particular resonance in history in 1941. There was a lot of good and a lot of bad there. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, Christmas in 1941 would have been just a couple weeks or so after the attack on Pearl Harbor and the beginning of our involvement in World War II.
Exactly. In that year, everything changed for Americans.
We're going to tap into the archives here at WNYC and also dig into some really amazing tape from the Library of Congress.
We'll hear from our contributors like we always do, and you're going to recognize them. And we'll take a look at how Americans are escaping from these times as well as engaging in them with an amazing year in sports and at the movies.
So take a guess for me. Do you have any idea how much a gallon of milk cost in 1941?
I could just guess, but I have no idea.
54 cents. And you could get yourself a brand new car for $850.
The book For Whom the Bell Tolls was a bestseller then, a Hemingway classic.
And people couldn't afford TV sets yet, so they all relied on radio. Here's some of the news on this December 25th, 1941.
The news is grim from the Pacific. This morning, with Japanese soldiers advancing throughout the city, Governor Mark Atchison Young officially surrendered the crown colony of Hong Kong to the Empire of Japan, marking the first time in history the British have surrendered to an invading force. British and Canadian soldiers have fought gallantly side by side for the last 17 days. The day will forever be known in Hong Kong as Black Christmas.
On the home front, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill is in Washington, D.C. to confer with President Roosevelt on the best military strategy to overrun the Axis powers. He gave a joint address with President Roosevelt from the White House last night.
Let the children have their night of fun and laughter. Let the gifts of Father Christmas delight their play. Let us grown-ups share to the full in their unstinted pleasures, before we turn again to the stern task and the formidable years that lie before us.
Your call, please.
To do your part in the war effort, telephone companies
ahead,
have
please.
Asked for you to refrain from all but the most urgent calls. The New York Telephone Company has this message for freedom-loving Americans. The long-distance lines must be kept open for defense use on this Christmas Eve. Since there will be no truce over the holidays, we feel sure you'll understand.
One message did get through from the Pacific. From the Marine garrison on Midway comes this message to the New York Times. We are still here. Merry Christmas. That's the news for this morning, December 25th, 1941.
After the Pearl Harbor attacks, our friends at the Library of Congress down in Washington took to the streets to get reaction from ordinary Americans about the times we're in now. We're joined now by one of them. Mike Stevens is in Dallas, Texas. Mike, how long have you lived in Dallas?
Well, I've been living in Dallas ever since 1934, which is about 7 years.
And what do you do for a living?
Well, I'm working in Dallas. I'm a houseman, chauffeur, cook, and a yard man.
We're asking people today, what do you think about this war we've just gotten into?
Well, my thoughts about the war, which I've been thinking over for some considerable time and reading, I figure we have a hard task to do.
Well, what do people like you think of this whole situation?
Well, the general colored people, I believe they will speak the same and portion with me, what I'm saying now, is because in talking with different ones, they talk the same thing.
Do you find them willing to bear their part and pick up arms and fight for their country?
Well, yes. I believe they feel like I felt when the news heard over radio that Japan had declared war on the United States. Everybody felt in sorrow and woke up with a strong determination mind is to go forward, to do the best they could.
Mike Stevens, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us. We're going to hear more reactions to the war and the attacks on Pearl Harbor all this hour.
It's 1941 on The Takeaway.
You're listening to a special edition of The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. We're imagining it's Christmas Day, 1941.
We're here on Christmas Day, 1941. In a minute, we're going to hear how some ordinary Americans are feeling about the war we're about to fight. But first, we have some news from Washington. Celeste?
Hi, John. Yes, just last night, President Roosevelt gave a major address from the south portico of the White House during the lighting of the National Community Christmas Tree. The president was joined this Christmas Eve by his new ally, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Winston Churchill. We have some tape from that speech all the way from Washington. And President Roosevelt seemed to address people who might be wondering if they should still celebrate Christmas when so many Americans are about to be sent to war.
How can we give our gifts? How can we meet and worship with love and with uplifted spirit and heart in a world at war, a world of fighting and suffering and death? How can we pause, even for a day, even for Christmas Day, in our urgent labor of arming a decent humanity against the enemies which beset it?
Roosevelt pointed out that Britain has been in this situation for some time already, and then he turned the microphone over to British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who reflected on the wartime holiday.
This is a strange Christmas Eve. Almost the whole world is locked in deadly struggle, and with the most terrible weapons which science can devise, the nations advance upon each other. Ill would it be for us this Christmastide if we were not sure that no greed for the land or wealth of any other people, no vulgar ambition, no morbid lust for material gain at the expense of others, had led us to the field. Here in the midst of war, raging and roaring over all the lands and seas, creeping nearer to our hearths and homes, here amid all the tumult, we have tonight the peace of the spirit in each cottage home and in every generous heart. Therefore, we may cast aside, for this night at least, the cares and dangers which beset us, and make for the children an evening of happiness in a world of storm.
Churchill is reportedly in Washington to plan the strategy for the war, and tomorrow he's going to address a joint session of Congress, the first by a foreign leader.
Voices there of two leaders waging this war. The formality of leaders who have to speak to the whole world, but here on The Takeaway, we like all kinds of voices, and we're going to turn now to some people who agreed to sit down for our microphones at the U.S. Library of Congress, thanks to a young fellow named Alan Lomax. Ordinary Americans, voices of ordinary Americans, you're going to hear them all hour. And we're going to start with two people from Austin, Texas, Mr. and Mrs. Jurosik. Mrs. Jurosik, let's start with you. My first question is really, are you for or against this war?
Well, I'm for it.
And you have a son that's going to fight, and you're ready to see him go off to fight?
They got to fight.
Why do they have to fight, Mrs. Jurosik?
Well, they've been attacked, so they've got to fight.
Well, let me talk to your husband then. Mr. Jurosik, what do you think we're fighting for here?
Well, we are fighting those greedy dictators. It's for the greedy gain that they're trying to make. They're trying to take stuff that don't belong to them.
Who does it belong to?
Well, rightfully, that's like Czechoslovakia belongs to Czechoslovakia. Poland belongs to Poland. Holland belongs to Holland, but Hitler's took it over.
What do you think about this country, the United States? Do you think it's the land of liberty?
It's the best country under the sun.
And you, Mrs. Jurosik?
Well, I think it is now. I think that's the reason we got to fight, to keep it that way.
And you two think war is the only way to keep it that way?
Yes, because I believe they're going to win the war.
No doubts about going to war?
Yes. Well, the country wouldn't be any good if let them have it.
I've got a son in the Army.
That's what I understand.
They have 3 years, and they called him back. He's been back about a year now.
In the reserve.
And you're fine that he's going to be on active duty now?
Well, wherever he's needed, he's ready to go, and I'm willing for him to go.
If you were eligible, would you go?
I'd like to go, but they wouldn't have me. My age would bar me.
Now, you're a working man. Do the other union men that you know in Austin have the same opinion? Would they all pick up and go?
Well, I believe the majority of them would go. But you'll always find men that would rather stay at home than anywhere else.
After it's over, what kind of peace do you think we ought to make with Japan, with Italy, and Germany?
Well, of course, that can be my honest opinion, you know. I think they ought to set up a different form of government.
Do you think they should have any power?
I think they ought to do away with some certain countries and do away with their tongue.
The tongue? You're talking about the language. Which languages should we do away with?
One's German. Don't let him speak it anymore. Divide Germany into other little countries there. Give each one of them a slice of it and do away with it.
What do you think about that, Mrs. Jurassic?
Well, I think that they shouldn't be in Germany anymore. I think they've caused enough trouble. I think when they whip them, they ought to not have Germany anymore.
You blame the Germans more than anyone else?
I do. I don't dislike the German people. I know a lot of German people that I don't dislike. But I remember in the World War was before, the way the thing went. And my children's daddy died from the effects of the World War. And now I've got a boy I got to go, and Germany's caused the whole thing. And I just think that Germany's caused enough trouble that we don't need the Germans.
And you feel the same way, Mr. Jurassic?
Exactly. I think that they ought to do away with that one country.
Well, what about Japan?
I don't think there's going to be much to Japan after this war.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. and Mrs. Joe Jurassic. Thanks for talking with us.
Coming up in a minute, why Uncle Sam wants you to buy war bonds. It's 1941 on The Takeaway.
Gasoline is an important defense material. Use it economically.
Don't gossip about ship movements or about the fact that a friend in the armed forces is being transferred to some outlying base. New York City's own station, WNYC.
I would die to be with my Dolores.
To be near her,
Dolores. I was made to serenade Dolores.
Now for an update on the news of Christmas 2009, I'm Mark Garrison. Pope Benedict will deliver his Christmas Day blessing as planned. He's okay just hours after being knocked down by a woman who jumped a barricade as the Pope walked down the aisle before midnight mass. Here's how it unfolded. This American tourist saw it happen.
All of a sudden, this person sort of flew over the barricade, and the Holy Father went down.
Bodyguards tackled the woman that attempted to reach Pope Benedict. The Vatican says she is mentally unstable and tried to reach out to the Pope the same time last year. The Pope got up and went on, but a cardinal was taken to the hospital. That's the sound of the bells of Bethlehem, where hundreds of worshipers, pilgrims, and tourists are in the traditional birthplace of Christ for morning mass. Here in America, icy roads are being blamed for 18 deaths, many from Nebraska and Kansas. Some churches have canceled Christmas services, and a state of emergency is in effect for South Dakota, Texas, and Oklahoma. The National Weather Service advises people to avoid traveling. Overseas again, Pakistani police say they're pursuing terrorism charges against five detained Americans. The five men, all in their late teens to mid-20s, were from the D.C. area. They were arrested by Pakistani police 2 weeks ago. In his weekly address, President Obama sent Christmas wishes to the nation and urged all Americans to find ways to thank our troops, the president and the first family, spending the holiday in Hawaii. Now back to our special edition of The Takeaway, Christmas 1941.
Listening to a special edition of The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston. We're imagining the show as if it's Christmas Day 1941. Now back to John and Celeste in 1941.
And so we've got some news takeouts that we're following this last week of 1941, and what a week in what a year, with the attack on Pearl Harbor still fresh in all of our minds. America is thinking about this war that's going on. But Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau says we should, as Americans, do much more.
We've got to step up the sale of war bonds to $1 billion every month. All of us who earn regular pay should set aside an average of at least 10% of it every week for buying war bonds.
Here to explain what war savings bonds are all about is Louise Story, an enterprising woman who covers finance and business for our friends, the New York Times.
Good morning.
So a war bond, I'm buying what exactly?
So the Series E bonds are the ones that they want everyday people out there, farmers and business owners and workers of all sorts to buy. They cost $18.75, and after 10 years, they'll pay you $25.
And they're going to use this money to support the war that I guess, have lent them, right?
Right. So you'll be lending the money, but they're saying, you know, it's a good investment for you. When you do the math, it only works out to about a 2.9% return per year.
Which is nothing like what you were getting back in the 1920s. That's
right,
sure.
Exactly. You remember the Liberty Bonds back then. The other way that you can help support the war is you can buy stamps. They're selling war stamps right at the post office, and those are a lot cheaper. You can buy those for 10 cents.
It'd be a good Christmas gift.
It would be a good Christmas gift. And I wonder if, you know, 60, 70, 80 years from now, people will still be thinking about these kinds of things, war bonds, as
no.
a good
Hopefully
investment.
We won't be having a war then.
Indeed. Louise Story, a business reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Any bonds today? Bonds of freedom, that's what I'm selling. Any bonds today? Scrape up the most you can. Here comes the freedom man, asking you to buy a share of freedom today. Any stamps, any bond today.
Our next takeout is all about that declaration of war that Congress passed earlier this month. You'll remember President Roosevelt made a very convincing speech to Congress on the morning after the Pearl Harbor attacks almost 3 weeks ago.
I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
After the president spoke, Congress approved the resolution in the record time of 33 minutes. Joining us now is our man in Washington, Todd Zwillick.
Good morning, Celeste.
Why did President Roosevelt have to go to Congress to declare this war?
Well, the Constitution reserves the power to declare war for the Congress and for the Congress alone. Article 1, Section 8 says that only Congress shall have the power to declare war. The president can't go to war to Japan on his own. He needs the consent of the Congress and, through them, the consent of the people.
And does that mean if the Congress says no, there's no other avenue, no other option for the president?
Well, the president is allowed to send troops overseas. He is the commander-in-chief of the military, but a declaration of war does a lot more than allow the president to send troops overseas. Doing things that the president needs to do in an emergency, like suspending habeas corpus or holding prisoners without trial, would be unthinkable without a declaration of war.
Here's another excerpt from that speech where President Roosevelt urged Congress to declare war.
We will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us.
After that kind of language, was there anyone in Congress who was against his proposal?
There actually was one dissenting vote. The war declaration passed the Senate 82-0, but there was a vote against it in the House. That was Congresswoman Jeanette Rankin. She's a Republican of Montana. Of course, students of history will remember that she also voted against the war resolution against Germany in 1917. She's a pacifist.
And how did people react to her no?
Well, there were some boos and hisses in the chamber. This is a patriotic moment for the House of Representatives and for the American people. So Congresswoman Rankin was not well received.
Well, we're going to hear next about how American citizens are responding. That's Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
Our last takeout comes from you, ordinary Americans all over the country, responding to the devastating attacks on Pearl Harbor earlier this month, speaking into the Library of Congress's microphones.
We were in our living room waiting for the symphony to come
For a moment, we were stunned. We just couldn't believe it at the moment. At first, I mean, it didn't seem true, and then the more we heard, the... Well, I don't know just how you'd say it. We were horrified.
That's Dorothy Baer from Buffalo, New York. And many of you are telling us your opinion of Japan after those attacks. Here's Edward Crane from Dallas, Texas.
I admit that while I've never had a very high opinion of the Japanese, their conduct in this particular situation has lowered them even in my estimation of them, which is low enough.
And some of you are putting the blame on our leaders.
All I got to say, they did the wrong thing by electing President Roosevelt. Although he helped some, he helped a whole lot, but still, therefore, he should have kept out of it.
It's affecting other people in different ways, but especially mothers who now have to see their sons go off to war, like Mrs. Whitaker from Austin, Texas.
And I'm glad to say that I have one son in the Army and that he's patriotic enough, and I have that Christian spirit in me to give our son for the cause, and I'm glad I did it, that my husband and I have done.
But some of you got right to the heart of the matter and wished it wasn't happening at all.
I'm a housewife in my 16th year and living in New York City. I'm very sorry the United States has to get into this war.
We'll hear more reaction to the war throughout this hour. It's Christmas 1941 on The Takeaway.
But God bless the child that's got his own.
I'm Mark Garrison. We'll get back to the special edition of The Takeaway in 1941 in a moment, but first these headlines. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict has just delivered his Christmas Day blessing, this after a rocky Christmas Eve Mass when a woman rushed him and knocked him down as he walked down the aisle to Mass. He was able to get up and celebrate that Mass. Vatican officials say the woman, who has a history of mental illness, they say, is the same one who breached security 1 year ago. Several states are waking up this Christmas morning under blizzard conditions, a fierce storm making its way across the Midwest. Has been blamed for at least 18 deaths. In a new video from the Taliban, apparently shows captured U.S. soldier Bo Bergdahl, who disappeared in June. Now back to our special edition of The Takeaway, Christmas 1941.
You're listening to a special edition of The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. We're imagining it's Christmas Day, 1941.
Coming up, a look at sports, 1941. There were a lot of headlines, but first, a word from some of our underwriters.
Billy Brown, the smoothest, coolest guy in town. The chicks all seem to dig his jive.
Hey, tell us, Bill, how can we arrive?
It's easy, Jack. Any gal gets sent when you flash a smile by Pepsodent. You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
And now we're going to hear about women in the news for today, December 25th, 1941.
Women in the News, presented by the Knee-High Bottling Company, Harlingen, bottlers in the Valley of Royal Crown Cola.
There has to be a first time for everything. And Washington, our nation's capital, is claiming the first American baby born during a blackout. It happened at the doctor's hospital during an air raid rehearsal. All the lights in the building, including the delivery room, had been shut off. Carol Ann Heater, who was about to enter the world, hadn't been told about blackouts. Luckily, there were several flashlights around, and the tiny daughter of Mr. and Mrs. John Heater, he's a clerk in the War Department, was greeted with plenty of light. And that brings up some of the good that is coming out of our defense preparations. War or no war, we'll all know lots more about fire hazards, and we'll know our neighbors better, too. Take Mrs. DeWitt Peterkin, wife of the New York banker. Last year, she was just an average young wife keeping house for her husband. Today, she is a cog in the country's defense machine. She works all day and two nights a week as an air raid warden. Her husband drills in the Home Guard two nights a week, and fortunately, they are the same two nights that she is busy. Mrs. Peterkin is interesting because she is typical of thousands of women in our country today. Here are her air warden duties. You'll admit they're a far cry from matinee, shopping, and a gin rummy. In order to check every fire hydrant and gas main in her neighborhood, Mrs. Peterkin walks a beat 2 blocks wide and 10 blocks long twice a day. She had to learn the location of gas and water outlets, and she had to make the acquaintance of every resident, how many children they have, and where invalids live. These also are an air raid warden's business. To qualify for the job, Mrs. Peterkin went to school at the American Women's Voluntary Service for several weeks. Ask this energetic worker about her private life, and she says, "Private life? I don't know the meaning of the word. This is the moment for public service. Only by serving publicly will we ever again have private life as we have so happily known it." And now for the names of the ladies who will receive the 6 Handy Home cartons of Royal Crown Cola Free. Mrs. J. Beatty Smith, San Juan. Mrs. Jim Corey, Mission. Mrs. H. C. Settles, Mercedes. Mrs. Lee West, McAllen. Mrs. L. F. Milliken, Weslaco. And Mrs. Wade Davis, San Benito. Cards entitling you ladies to your free 6 bottle cartons of Royal Crown Cola will be mailed tonight. They're redeemable at your favorite grocery store or Royal Crown dealers.
That's all you need to know about women in the news right here on The Takeaway.
And remember, ladies, we'll give away 6 more Handy Home cartons of Royal Crown Cola. So listen for your name.
The camera highlights in the world of sports.
Well, it was certainly a year in sports in 1941. Some of the highlights, and you know, we've got legends all over the place. Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, Joe Louis. One legend's a pony.
They're turning into the stretch with Whirlaway on the lead. And his jockey looking back. He's not running wide. It is Whirlaway by 3 lengths. Whirlaway is coming on away to be another horse to win the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness.
Whirlaway, of course, the horse that won the coveted Triple Crown this year, the 5th time that's ever been done. It was a fast but erratic chestnut colt that had a streak of wins already when it went into the starting gate at this year's Kentucky Derby.
And they're away.
And he came from the back of the Derby and flew through the final quarter to win by 8 lengths. He did the same at the Preakness with a 5.5-length victory, but then at Belmont, it was all over. He catapulted into a 7-length lead after a slow start. At the final turn, he seemed to veer off course until legendary jockey Eddie Arcaro straightened him out to get that Triple Crown with an easy 2.5-length win. Then in the boxing ring, there was the challenger.
The very capable challenger, Billy Cunn.
Capable. Well, some thought he was a credible threat to the heavyweight title held by Joe Louis. 17 challengers have come before him, and this year, Cunn was supposed to be different, trying to become the world's first light heavyweight champion in boxing history to win the heavyweight crown, and the crowd believed he could win. Cunn was actually, if you watch the fight, was actually winning on the scorecards up to around 13. Louis heard the words of his trainer in his ears. The reporter said, "You have to knock him out to win." And in the 13th, Louis pummeled Cunn, knocking him down after 38 minutes of fighting. The referee counted 10 as Cunn got on his feet. Split second too late. He was counted out. So Joe Louis, 1941, remains the undefeated heavyweight champion, maybe even the greatest of all time. It was certainly a good year. In my book, it's always a good year in sports for baseball, but not so much for the Brooklyn Dodgers. They smelled victory in the World Series against the New York Yankees this year. They had a chance to even the series in Game 4. Dodgers had a 4-3 lead in the 9th inning with no Yankees on base. Then, something happened.
So again, we've come up to a 3-2 pitch. 2 out in the 9th inning. Casey gets by Henrik. It's all over. You're starting his windup out there again. He's all ready now. Watch it. Here it comes. He swung, fouled the ball. He swung at the ball and missed it. The ball gets away from the catcher, and Henrik goes to first.
Oh, I live in Brooklyn. How much does that hurt? The error, and it was charged as an error, kept the Yankees alive. They came back to get a 7-4 win, and they won the series. Couple of baseball legends to talk about here in 1941. You know, which record do you think is going to stand the test of time here? Sportsman of the Year this 1941 has to be Joe DiMaggio. Record-breaking 56-game hitting streak, inspiring a song.
Joe DiMaggio.
But what about Ted Williams?
Remember this day, fans. September 28, 1941. It may be a history-making day.
At Shibe Park in Philadelphia, 23-year-old Ted Williams did it. Boston Red Sox, 23-year-old, what kind of batting average is a .406 batting average for the entire season? Try that for a record.
.406, not too bad a day.
And not too bad a season. I mean, his best yet. But there's one more legend who still gets all the attention, even though he's retired.
Hey, gang, come on, here's Babe Ruth!
Hello, boys and girls. That's the way. Just call me Babe.
Why do they call you Babe?
Why do they call me Babe?
Well, I'll tell you. A few years before you were born, I was playing with the Baltimore Orioles. And when I went to Baltimore, and in Fayetteville, North Carolina, was my first appearance. And when the coach saw me come in, he said, "There comes this big baby." So baby has stuck to me ever since. Hello, Sonny. What's your name?
Billy Ruthven.
Billy Ruthven. How old are you, Billy?
12 years old.
12 years old. Well, you're a pretty big fellow to be 12. You got a favorite team?
Yes, the Dodgers.
Uh-oh.
How about that?
Well, there was some cheers and boos in that. I don't know. Now, what is your name, Sonny?
Edward.
Edward who?
Sheedy.
Sheedy, huh? Well, how old are you?
Seven.
Have you got a favorite team? What is it?
The Yankees.
Yankees. Good for you.
I'll look at the movies of 1941 in just a minute. It's 1941 on The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And I was looking at my own mailbag here and was struck by a Christmas card I received from one of my friends this year. Dark, kind of somber background, a single candle. Really captures the mood of what we're all feeling, I think, this Christmas of 1941. A nation at war against Japan and Germany at the same time. But then I went back and looked at some old cards of holidays past, and I found this very different card from 1911. A very happy-looking Christmas bell with two children holding ribbons. They're little angels. Almost a different world, it seems, than just 30 years ago. Listen to this.
Little girl, that's a nice little girl. It's a right little girl for me. She don't have to look like a girl in a book. It's a good book she could be.
That's from 1911. Sounds like they don't have a care in the world, those singers. Think about it. It's much less than a lifetime ago, but it's almost impossible to imagine back 30 years ago. Before the Great War, all of those millions of people who died in Europe were still alive. The Great Depression, the stock market crash, all in the distant future. The Communist Revolution in Russia hadn't happened. Getting through the just past 19th century seemed a miracle all by itself. Hard to recall what it even felt like. Hey, in 1911, people stopped hand-cranking their cars. The starter was invented. Standard Oil was broken up. Of course, the horrible Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire here in New York City transformed our idea of safety, where we all work. You know, someday I suppose we'll have the recording ability to preserve the voices from any time and go back and hear and see what it was like, maybe even more than 30 years ago. But now we're left with these distant echoes from 1911. Just 11 years into the new 20th century, there was such a feeling of satisfaction. Napoleon and his horrible wars were over. We thought they were horrible back then, anyway. We survived the war between the states here in the United States, freed the slaves, became a bigger economy than our old colonial master, England. 1911 seemed like a long summer historical day.
Any girl looks good in summer.
I was looking at some other important events back in 1911. The great composer Gustav Mahler died. Complicated fellow. Do you like his music? He never got to hear one of his most ambitious pieces performed, The Song of the Earth, it was called. Premiered in October of 1911 after he was dead. I don't know if you've heard the piece, but it contains all this brooding sense that there's something right around the corner. Something big. And maybe not so great. What did Gustav Mahler know? What's he thinking now? One last thing before we go. I love this. 30 years ago, movies were a silent novelty, and most were made in Europe. But in 1911, a man by the name of David Horsley opened a little movie studio out in California on Sunset Boulevard in a little place the world now knows as Hollywood.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston. We're imagining the show as if it's Christmas Day 1941, back to John and Celeste in 1941.
It's great looking back in this 1941. And I think if you look back a decade, you realize that what made it through the Depression was the movie industry in the United States. President Roosevelt talked about that recently.
We have seen the American motion picture become foremost in all the world. We've seen it reflect our civilization throughout the rest of the world. The aims and the aspirations and the ideals of a free people and of freedom itself.
Of course, President Roosevelt speaking there. For me, it's more about escape, and that's why we have invited Rafer Guzman, our own movie correspondent, here into the studio to talk about the year in movies, 1941. I think escape is what most Americans do when they go into the movie theater. Don't you agree?
I think that's true. I think you want to get a little popcorn, sit back, enjoy the show, and forget about your problems.
And it's only a penny, right? I mean,
that's right.
That's the best part about it. So what are the films do you think are big this year? One thing that struck out for me was this movie, Maltese Falcon. I mean, you see a New York screenwriter, John Huston, going out to Hollywood trying to make good. Dashiell Hammett, of course, who wrote the book,
right.
Maltese Falcon. What do you think of this movie?
I think it's really great, and I think it's got a fantastic acting troupe in it with, you know, Humphrey Bogart.
This new guy. Let's listen to this clip and hear.
What have you ever given me beside money? Have you ever given me any of your confidence, any of the truth? Haven't you tried to buy my loyalty with money and nothing else?
What else is there I can buy you with?
Humphrey Bogart there, kind of a funny voice.
Yeah, very, very distinctive voice. This is sort of one of his first breakout roles I think we've seen from him so far, and he does a great job in it as a hard-bitten detective. It's also a very dark film, even though it is a good escapist film. Dashiell Hammett, you know, he knows how to throw some punches, and he's not messing around here.
Well, a lot of people were wondering if Dashiell Hammett would translate to the screen. Here, I think it does, but I wonder if this Humphrey Bogart fellow is going to get kind of cast in these characters from here on out.
It's a good question. He's got such a great face for it. I guess he could be a victim of typecasting in the future.
Indeed. Well, another New Yorker, huge in New York, comes out to Hollywood, tries to make it big. Listen to this movie.
I am the publisher of The Enquirer. As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests.
The movie's called Citizen Kane. Orson Welles plays the main character, and this is supposedly the climax of the entire movie right here. Did he say Rosebud, Rafer Guzman?
He did say Rosebud. I don't want to give it away, but it's a word that has great symbolic value for this character of Kane.
Now, this is a long movie. I have to say, I understood The War of the Worlds on the radio much better than I understood this film. I liked it, but it was pretty tough going.
I mean, I think the real value in this film, that what's gotten the critics excited about it, is the technical innovations here. You may not notice it as an average filmgoer, but the way that the cinematographer Greg Toland uses focus and what they call deep focus to put all the points of the picture in focus so that you see everything clearly, the foreground and the background and the middle ground, it's pretty tremendous. It's almost three-dimensional the way he does this.
You're kind of a technical guy, all this camera stuff moving around.
Well, you know, Orson Welles is too. I mean, people say that he's a real megalomaniac, but if you notice, he shares his title card of director with Greg Toland, the cinematographer. Directors usually don't do that. They usually want to put their own name on the screen alone with nobody else on it. So he did that.
Rafer Guzman loves Citizen Kane, not doing great at the box office, but
That's true. Say
maybe a legend in the making.
I think we will see more from this guy.
All right. It seems to me maybe the most significant film this year is about a story that anticipates where we are here in 1941 with the war and Pearl Harbor so close upon us. Sergeant York, tell us a little bit about that.
It's a true story based on the life of Alvin York, the most decorated soldier from the Great War of 1914. And this, you know, this film has got Gary Cooper in the lead role, and it's great to see Gary Cooper playing sort of a yokel of sorts, and he does it very well. Basically, he's living out in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee. It's so remote they don't even know there's a war coming, and they wind up getting drafted. And he doesn't want to go. He's a conscientious objector, but he actually actually goes to the mountaintop. He sits and he thinks about it, and he decides that, yes, indeed, he's got to come down and fight for his country.
Well, let's listen. Here's Gary Cooper.
I believe in the Bible, and I'm believing that this here life we're living is something the Lord done give us, and we got to be living it the best we can. And I'm figuring that killing other folks ain't no part of what he was intending for us to be a-doing here.
Oh, love that Gary Cooper.
He's great in it.
It's got to be an Oscar contender because it so coincides with the way we're feeling now.
I think it does, and I think it really has a strong message to say that you can reconcile your personal, your religious beliefs with the way that you want to fight for the country. Mm-hmm. And I think it probably says a lot about where America is right now and the feelings that people are having about the war that's upon us.
A lot of people are going to identify with Sergeant York. I think you're right about that, so. Right, for Guzman's. All right, the Disney movie, after the, I thought, a little too serious Fantasia, beautiful, but, not much of a movie as far as I'm concerned. Yeah,
apparently most of the public was with you. Yeah. Not a big success at the box office.
Who would have thought a little flying elephant takes the hearts of America away? What's the movie?
It's called Dumbo, and it's sort of a return to form for Disney, I think, after this extravagant Fantasia that they've done. I think it's a really wonderful film. It's really heartbreaking. It's about a little elephant whose ears are so enormous that he becomes an outcast. And, of course, he's got a kind of a Jiminy Cricket character, a mouse that, right, on his shoulder, that figures out that his ears are, in fact, so big they can actually help him fly.
And you fall in love with this little elephant from
you
the
do.
Beginning.
Dumbo! You flew! Boy, am I stupid! Why not think of this before? Your ears! Just look at them, Dumbo! Why, they're pointy wings! The very things that held you down are going to carry you up and up and up!
Well, Dumbo will be competing for sentimentality with How Green Was My Valley. That's got to be an Oscar contender, just released.
Definitely. A very populous film about the coal mining family in Wales. It's pretty difficult to overlook the sentimentality in that one, but it's very well done. John Ford, terrific
Huge
director.
Cast. Walter Pidgeon, Maureen O'Hara, Anna Lee, Donald Cripps, Roddy McDowell.
Roddy McDowell,
young,
yes.
Young kid. Let's finish out the year by noting, and we talked about this a little earlier in the hour, Hollywood, they broke ground on the first Hollywood studio like 30 years ago.
Is that right? This
fall, yeah.
It was 30 years ago. Well, how far we've come.
And so we dominate the world in movies.
Indeed we do.
Rafer Guzman, the takeaway movie contributor.
I saw clothes on the Raven Buck.
And they tell me that a man made a vegetable truck.
I didn't see that. I only heard.
Just to be sociable, I'll take your word.
I heard a fireside chat.
I saw a baseball bat.
And I just laughed till I thought I'd die.
But I'll be done seen about everything when I see an elephant fly.
Now let's hear from some more ordinary Americans on this Christmas 1941.
My name is James Bopp. I live in New York City. I work on the custodian staff at City College. And what Roosevelt did, he couldn't do anything else. It was forced upon us. There's nothing else for us to do but fight.
Yes, I'm ready any time. The Uncle Sam needed me, I'll be ready. I know Mexico is my country, but I left my country. And the longest I've been living here, and they've been treating me good, I'm American citizen now, and I just call this my country.
My name is Richard Kwan. I work for the city of New York. I think President Roosevelt's speech was excellent. And I think it is the only means of meeting the aggression of the Japanese by declaring war. And I think all the people of the United States will be behind the president because his speech was an excellent performance of his duty towards the people of this state. And I assure you that every working man will be behind the president in his hour of need.
My name's Willie Clay. I'm from Benson, Arizona. I was born and raised on a cattle ranch. I've rode bulls and bareback horses, and I'm here for this big show, and what we all got in mind now is this war. What I think of it, I'm coming 21 years of age this next month. I got to register the 16th, and I'm going to volunteer in for this Navy. Cause I think their clothes fits more like Levi's, and besides, men can get in there and do action.
We're leaving you with this music by the German-American opera singer Lotte Lehmann. It's from a radio recital that was heard all over America this Christmas, 1941. Before she started singing, she urged listeners to put aside the despair that surrounds us and live in the hope that a time will come when all nations and races will be free.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, all this week on The Takeaway, we've been asking you for your favorite Christmas songs, and you've definitely responded, some of them traditional, some of them silly, and some of them downright morbid, frankly. So I thought I'd take a second and play just a couple of my favorites.
Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight.
We three kings of Orient are, bearing gifts we traverse upon.
Those are just two of my favorites, but you know, for me, nothing compares to this. This is a visit from the planet Mars to the Bing Crosby Merry Old Christmas Special, 1977.
Oh, I'm David Bowie. I live down the road.
Oh. Peace on earth. Can it be? Years from now, perhaps we'll see.
All this and a lot of yours as well on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's December 25th, and a very Bowie Christmas to you. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in this morning for John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. Mark Garrison is here joining me with the headlines this morning. Mark, good morning. It's good to see you.
Good morning, Todd. Good to be here. Here are the top stories we're following this Christmas. Mass at the Vatican is normally predictable and flawless, but just listen to what happened as Pope Benedict walked the aisle to celebrate Mass. You're hearing a woman jumping the barricade, rushing the Pope, and then knocking him down right before Christmas Eve Mass. This California visitor saw it happen.
She kind of lunged her arms out and grabbed onto the Pope, and that's when they all went down together.
The Pope got up and continued. The Vatican says the woman is mentally ill. She was involved in a similar incident last year. NATO now confirms the captured U.S. soldier Bo Bergdahl is the man shown in a new Taliban hostage video out today. Bergdahl went missing from Afghanistan in June.
Here in the U.S., severe weather conditions are making their way across the Plains region. They've prompted the first blizzard warning in Kansas in over a decade, and all right on time for the holidays, of course. Joining us now is Matt Walters, meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Topeka, Kansas. Matt, good morning. Merry Christmas.
Good morning, and Merry Christmas to you.
Matt, severe storms have prompted the blizzard warning. What are the conditions on the ground there?
Well, conditions here across northeast Kansas, Topeka, Kansas City, are actually beginning to improve. The snow is beginning to lighten up, and people are beginning to assess and see how much they have to dig out.
All right, good news from the Midwest. We have a blizzard warning, but if you're getting back in the car this afternoon after your Christmas holiday, it might not be quite so bad as it could have been this morning. Matt Walters from the National Weather Service, thanks so much.
The Pakistani police say they are pursuing terrorism charges against five detained Americans. The D.C. area men are accused of trying to link up with militant groups with the intent of fighting Americans in Afghanistan. And after a tough economic year, President Obama hopes the true meaning of Christmas will encourage people who have lost homes and jobs.
Even in these tough times, there's still so much to celebrate this Christmas. A message of peace and brotherhood that continues to inspire more than 2,000 years after Jesus' birth.
The president and his family are spending the holiday in Hawaii. Markets are closed for Christmas. Yesterday, Wall Street closed at highs for the year. Tom?
Coming up, tomorrow marks the five-year anniversary of a powerful tsunami in the Indian Ocean that killed 200,000 people and left millions more homeless. We're going back to look at 5 years of relief efforts in the affected area and how they've improved in Indonesia and around the Indian Ocean. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Now, all week long, we've been asking you, the listeners, to call in and sing us your favorite holiday tunes. Today, we're wrapping up our Remixing the Holiday series, but we still want to hear your favorites. What are you listening to today, and what are you happy to not hear again till next year? Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Of course, if you call, you get to sing, and that's the most important part because we've got Christmas music like this on tap. We are wrapping up our holiday music remix series with these guys. That's Twisted Sister. They've written a record that really brings the holiday spirit. It's a very, very metal Christmas on The Takeaway. That's later this hour.
Guitar.
Just saw this big wall of water just coming straight for us and just started running. I had both of them in my hands and one in each arm, and then we started going under.
That's the voice of one survivor of the Indian Ocean tsunami talking about running from the wave of water 5 years ago. Tomorrow is the fifth anniversary of the tsunami. It wreaked havoc across 11 countries, killing a staggering 200,000 people and making millions more homeless. The BBC's Karishma Vaswani has recently visited the Indonesian capital of Aceh, which was decimated during the tsunami. She's been meeting survivors and joins us now from the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. Karishma, good morning.
Good morning.
And Merry Christmas to you. Karishma, this solemn anniversary, 5 years since the tsunami, how are people in Aceh marking this anniversary?
Well, on Saturday, the actual anniversary of the tsunami, what we've been told is that there will be commemorative ceremonies held in the province. The Indonesian vice president is expected in Aceh to host and hold these ceremonies. You can surely understand this is something I think no one there will ever forget. I mean, every single person I met either lost somebody in the tsunami or they themselves had been affected in some way. No one's been untouched by this disaster. Apart from the ceremonies that are being held tomorrow, what we've also heard is that there will be some events taking place at the tsunami memorial, the museum that's been erected there just in the last year, in fact, where they've built a museum and a memorial to the victims of the tsunami. There's also a photo exhibition on display of some of the images from that time.
Karishma, you've been going around Aceh and talking to residents there. Everyone there is a survivor, in a sense, as you said, no one was untouched, a member of their family killed or their property destroyed. Tell us one or two stories of the people that you've met there and how they've tried to rebuild their lives.
Well, one story in particular comes to mind. I was in Banda Aceh, which is the capital of the Achenese province, and it was totally destroyed after the tsunami. People speak of it being a wasteland. But today, when you walk around the city, I mean, I've compared images from when my colleagues were out there 5 years ago. It's a bustling city. You know, the motorcycles ply the streets. There are shops on every corner selling everything from jilbabs to blue jeans. And it is an amazing improvement to what there was 5 years ago. And some even say to what there was before the tsunami.
Are you able to say that things are nearly back to normal?
I would say that certainly in parts of the city, things are nearly back to normal. And this particular story will illustrate that, I hope. This gentleman by the name of Junaidi owned a store on the high street. And at the time, it was completely washed away by the tsunami. It was a one-story store. Today, he's built back to three stories. His store is now the largest, or one of the largest, rather, in Aceh. But yet, just to underline how much of a tragedy this this still is to people there today, when we asked him how he felt about being so successful, he broke down. He was unable to complete his sentence, his conversation with me, because he was still so upset from what had happened 5 years ago. He said nothing, no success can ever make up for the people that he's lost in his life, the pain of the past. The success of the present can't make up for that.
Well, I want to bring in now Christoph Gorder. He's Vice President of Emergency Response with AmeriCares, who's also been in the area. AmeriCares is an international aid organization that's been working on tsunami relief efforts for the last 5 years. Christoph, good morning.
Good morning.
Merry Christmas to you. Karishma says that in the region of Aceh in Indonesia, in some ways things are almost back to normal, at least physically, the physical nature of the area. What have you found around the rest of the region as they've tried to rebuild after the devastation 5 years ago?
Well, I think Karishma's observations are spot on, and the big distinction between the physical reconstruction and then the human loss that will be felt for much, much longer. And so, yes, the buildings have been rebuilt, the bridges have been rebuilt, we've rebuilt schools and hospitals, we've helped people get their businesses up and going throughout the region, in India, in Sri Lanka, and in Indonesia is where we've primarily been working. And yes, life has gone on, but I think that the emotional and the psychological damage is probably as close to, the devastation that you would have observed right after the tsunami.
Karishma, there's been an enormous amount of money pouring into the region, and rightfully so, since the disaster. What has been the dispensation of that money? Did you get any sense on the ground that it's been used to full effect?
Well, this was a question that was asked a number of times right after the tsunami and since in the years since, simply because, as you say, the amount was unprecedented. The results of the donations from around the world, money just pouring into places like Aceh after seeing those images on the television screens. It was said to be the largest relief operation since the Second World War.
Christoph Gorder, we talk about infrastructure rebuilding and hopefully some mental public health. What still needs to happen, in your view, to make this a full recovery? What's left undone?
Well, the tail end after a disaster of this magnitude, and actually, after many emergencies, the tail end is very long. And I think people talk about the full recovery taking at least a generation. I mean, you think about where we are in terms of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina here in our country. There's a lot more work that needs to be done in New Orleans. So I think that there's an enormous amount of work that still needs to be done, both in infrastructure and then in rebuilding the communities that will take a very long time. And so yes, there is a lot of work that remains to be done, and particularly in affected communities. I think it takes almost a generation for all the wounds to heal.
Karishma Vaswani, we heard after the disaster a rush to install better warning systems in the ocean, seismic warning systems, so that the next time there's a tsunami, people can get to higher ground. Are those warning systems in place? Where are we at?
Well, we're almost there, but not quite. Just in the month of October, in fact, the countries who were affected by the Indian Ocean tsunami all got together. There was a big tsunami warning drill system. This is something that they've been trying to practice ever since the tsunami, under the auspices of the United Nations as well, a worldwide effort. But by and large, the criticism has been that although there's been funds for this activity, the money's there, the countries haven't gone so far as to implement these funds in the proper way. For example, in the most recent earthquake that we had in Indonesia in October, in Sumatra, it was said that even if the early warning system had been in place, the people who would have been most affected by a tsunami would not have been warned in time. So just another illustration about the fact that even 5 years on from a disaster that will probably remain in our memory as the disaster that changed the definition of all natural disasters in the world, we're still nowhere near where we need to be to warn the people most at risk.
Thank you, Karishma Vaswani, BBC reporter in Indonesia, who was in Banda Aceh in Indonesia. She joins us this morning from Jakarta. And Christoph Gorder, Vice President of Emergency Response for AmeriCares by phone here in New York. Thank you both for joining us. Now at 15 minutes past the hour, Mark Garrison is here with a look at the headlines.
Thank you, Todd. Good morning. Parts of Texas are experiencing their first white Christmas in decades. Officials in several states have closed highways. There is a storm across the Midwest. The National Weather Service says people should stay home and pack emergency kits if they absolutely have to travel. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict has given his Christmas Day blessing. He appears fine after a woman broke through security and knocked him over at Mass last night. The Vatican says the woman has a history of mental problems. She tried to do the same thing a year ago. Mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now have access to unlimited American taxpayer dollars. The Treasury Department announced on Christmas Eve that it's removing the cap to money it will give to keep the companies afloat. They've already gotten $111 billion. And those are some of the stories we're following.
And something you really need to download today from our a special edition of our show, The Takeaway as Heard on Christmas Day 1941. We've dipped into the archives to hear how Americans were feeling just after Pearl Harbor when we were suddenly a nation at war. This is a great production from The Takeaway. Go to thetakeaway.org to download it and hear it all.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley this morning. Merry Christmas. Let's get some takeouts on stories we're following this week. For our Washington takeout, Congress has already scattered to the four winds, and so is the president. Air Force One was on to Hawaii yesterday, where the first family is taking their Christmas vacation. Carol Lee, reporter for Politico.com, is traveling with the president. Carol, good morning.
Good morning, Todd. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. You're warm down there in Hawaii, I'm sure of it. You know, the president said he's going to continue working on health care through his vacation. Is that just typical sort of White House rhetoric, the president never rests, or is there really work to be done?
I think there's really some work to be done. I mean, obviously the president is going to be relaxing quite a bit. He'll probably hit the golf course as he usually does here. And it's really nice, I've got to say. It's the opposite of what Washington is right now. When he stepped off of Air Force One, it was 80 degrees outside. He seemed relaxed. He was casually dressed. And I had traveled with the press corps on Air Force One. And once we motorcated to their home, which is in a pretty residential, nice area on the northern side of the island, the first family was immediately in for the night. I mean, I'm sure today they're going to stay in and exchange gifts and have some dinner, and the president may go work out on the military base, which he did last year this morning, and he might do perhaps a military event or some other type of event. Last year he went and met with troops at a Marine base nearby where the first family is staying. The president's always going to be working while he's on vacation. There's a lot to be done on health care, but he's also going to be taking some time to relax and hang out with friends. He's got a bunch of friends from Chicago coming in, and there's childhood friends here and family.
All right. The Western White House, as they used to call it, has moved way west to the Big Island of Hawaii. Carol Lee from Politico is there filing in her flip-flops, I'm sure. Carol, thanks for joining us. All right, let's move on to movies. There's movies to be seen this weekend. We're joined, as always, by Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Takeaway contributor. Merry Christmas, Rafer.
Good morning. Merry Christmas to you.
We got a list to run down here, Rafer. First, in wide release this weekend, Sherlock Holmes, starring Robert Downey Jr. and the great Jude Law. Listen to this.
Mr. Holmes, you must widen your gaze. You underestimate the gravity of coming events. Tomorrow, at midday, the world as you know it will end.
Well, there isn't any time to waste then, is there?
Frankly, I'm a little surprised that didn't say elementary, but it didn't. What's the verdict, Rafer?
I like this movie a lot. I think this is a good crowd pleaser. You know, Guy Ritchie, usually an R-rated director with movies like Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Right.
He's reining in the brutality a little bit here to make a PG-13 rating. I personally would have liked a little more blood and guts, but I think if you're looking for a good Christmas movie, this is probably the one.
Okay, if they had too much blood and guts, I suppose we'd have to move it till after New Year's for you.
That's right.
Thanks. Well, next we've got a romantic comedy. It's called It's Complicated. Alec Baldwin, Steve Martin, and Meryl Streep. Let's listen to this one.
OMG, I thought he'd never leave.
What are you doing here?
I'm having an affair with a married man.
You're not saying.
Oh, yes, I am. Turns out, I'm a bit of a slut.
Typical guy, I guess I am, Rafer. I'd stay away from a romantic comedy, but the combination of Alec Baldwin and Meryl Streep might bring me out. What do you think?
I got to tell you, Alec Baldwin is really the reason to see this movie. I mean, you know, just the fact that he says OMG, you know, that he can pull that he can pull that line off. He is really the best thing about it. It's actually very smart. It's very funny. If it didn't have this good of a cast, I might not recommend it. But it's pretty hard to beat the people that are in this one.
Hard to beat Meryl Streep for sure. Finally, Rafer, we have Terry Gilliam of Monty Python fame. He has a new fantasy film, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. It's Heath Ledger's last film before he passed away. It's out in limited release. What do you think of this one?
I have to say that the sad part about this, especially since this is Heath Ledger's last film, he died mid-production, it's a complete disaster. It's absolutely incomprehensible, unwatchable. I was really sad because I'm also a Terry Gilliam fan, but I can't recommend this one.
Could you be a little more unambiguous for us, Rafer? We appreciate it.
how can I say this? Don't go see this movie.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Takeaway contributor. Merry Christmas, Rafer. Let's move on to a sports takeout now. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is in the studio with me. Ibrahim, football, San Diego Chargers, playoff hopeful, visiting the Tennessee Titans. This is the AFC now.
So in the AFC, this is interesting. The San Diego Chargers are on a 9-game win streak. They're the hottest team in the NFL, besides, of course, the Indianapolis Colts, who are undefeated. They also have the fifth-best passing offense and the middle of the pack, 15th ranked defense. So they haven't had a great defense, but their offense has held them and taken them over the top. And at the end of any game, Philip Rivers, the quarterback, will be able to take over any game, and the Chargers are hot. Tennessee Titans, on the other hand, they started off 0-6. They've come back. Now they're 7-7. Their playoff hopes are very slim, but these are the two of the hottest teams in the league right now. It should be a great game.
Now, you've said that the NFC has come into sharp focus. The AFC is a little more muddled. Is the AFC getting any clearer now of the playoff picture?
The AFC, well, you know, the AFC is still, there's still six teams at 7-7. So it's still a little unclear who's going to get that the wild card spots. So it's not actually any clearer. And today might make it a little bit clearer, but it's not actually any clearer.
All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Hang in, because we're going to be talking about some of the Christmas songs we've been getting here on the Takeaway, and I want to keep you in the studio because we're going to judge some of these. It's going to be a lot of fun, so hang in. You know, all week, listeners have been calling us to sing their favorite holiday tunes. Today we're wrapping up our remix series, and we want to know what's your guilty pleasure holiday song. Here's Desmond from Detroit.
Hi, my guilty pleasure holiday song is Santa Claus Goes Straight to the Ghetto. It kind of goes, Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto.
Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto.
There's more of this to come. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org, as always. But if you call, you can sing for us a little bit. We're going to rate some of these favorites in just a few minutes. Ibrahim's going to hang in with me. Mark Arison's going to hang in, too. And we're going to review some of the best Christmas songs of the week. There's some good ones. You want to hear this. Good morning, it's Todd Zwillick filling in for John and Celeste this Christmas morning. Coming up, did a priest in England really tell his congregation that it's okay to steal? We'll hear from that priest in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on the headlines with Mark at 31 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Todd. The Midwest is buried right now. A nasty winter storm has snow pelting an area stretching from Texas to North Dakota, and it's moving east. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict has delivered his Christmas Day blessing. It went as planned. Not so, though, his Christmas Eve Mass. A woman rushed him and knocked him down as he walked the aisle. He was okay and able to get up and celebrate Mass. A new Taliban video out this morning shows a captured U.S. soldier. NATO confirms it is Private Bo Bergdahl, who went missing from Afghanistan in June. And those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Here's a Christmas question for you. Is it okay to steal? So says a priest in England. Father Tim Jones, a local parish priest, told his congregation earlier this week that under certain circumstances, it is okay to steal. Father Jones, from what I've read, do I have it right? It's okay for some people to steal this Christmas?
I wouldn't say okay. I think stealing is a terrible thing. The point I was making was that sometimes in our society, we leave people at the very bottom with no legal options. People can either live off their savings, but many people at the bottom have none. They can earn money, but people at the very bottom can find it extraordinarily difficult to get a job. They could live off the charity of friends and family. But increasingly in our society, people have ever more dysfunctional families who aren't prepared to support people semi-indefinitely. People can live off the benefits system, but we all know that the system very often just doesn't function smoothly, doesn't get people's payments to them in a timely fashion. Any kind of things can cause a hiccup in the arrival of benefits, or people can live on charity. And the harsh reality in Britain today is that people just do not give enough to charity. And so many people find themselves with none of those five legitimate options open to them. And the point I was making is when we as a society take away every legitimate option, people have nothing left other than the illegitimate options. And that's as much our fault as theirs.
And if people exercise what you call the illegitimate option and go into a mom-and-pop shop that probably doesn't make much profit to begin with and steals there because they have no other means, what does that accomplish?
It accomplishes nothing. It does nothing other than transfer the desperation from one place to another, which is why in my sermon I said as soon as you start giving people nothing other than appalling options, you then have to start working out what morally is the best thing to do when people are left nothing with dreadful options. And what I said in that situation was, while it is a terrible thing to leave someone in a situation where they have to steal, I would much rather that they stole from large national chains rather than mom-and-pop stores, because in this climate, the mom-and-pop stores are themselves struggling in quite dreadful ways to keep their heads above water as well. So the point I was making generally in the sermon was that the fact that we as a society create this situation is the most appalling indictment of who we are, that we become ever more comfortable with people at the bottom of our society living in destitution, where they face the kind of choices that most of us who are not in that situation, we just can't imagine the kind of choices that people face.
It's Father Tim Jones from St. Lawrence Church in York, England, with some non-conventional advice for people left at the bottom of society. Father Tim Jones, thank you so much for joining us. Now on to something a little lighter this morning. All week long, we've offered you extra points for calling into The Takeaway and singing your favorite holiday songs. Well, we got to tally up the extra points now, and we've brought in a few judges here, our own Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributors here. So is Mark Garrison. Hi, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, Mark and Ibrahim, let's listen to one of our Takeaway favorites here.
Good morning. Troy calling from North Dakota. You know, public radio always making those on-air appeals for funding. I will write a check for $100 and drop it in the mail tomorrow if Femi Okay comes on the air and sings the whole song, my favorite Christmas song, Santa Baby.
Good morning, Troy. Happy holidays. Now, I'm not in the studio this morning, but it doesn't mean we can't be Christmassy. Santa Baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa Baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight.
All right, Ibrahim is beside himself right
here.
Ibrahim is beside himself, but we have to disqualify Femi.
No, perhaps for Boxing Day, though. She can come back and sing for that.
This is a little unfair.
Yeah, Femi's ineligible to win, even though she might be the winner in our hearts. So let's move on to those who are eligible now. We have one of our wonderfully talented listeners, is Marianne from Detroit, who called 8778-MY-TAKE with this festive song.
This is Marianne from Detroit. My favorite holiday song is Malakalikimaka.
Is a thing to say.
Because it reminds me of a Griswold Christmas.
As far as I'm concerned, Marianne gets points for saying Malakalikimaka, because the other day I couldn't even say
good
it.
Pronunciation, yeah.
Yeah. So I think she gets points for pronunciation.
I have a scale of 1 to 5, and I'm going to give that one a 2.5.
Oh.
2.5.
You're
she
tough
didn't
coming
sing
out of
more
the
than that one phrase.
Just the one line.
Do you like dock points for not being in the 48 like contiguous states? Like, is there like can we get some Alaskan Christmas, and you're just going to totally neg it?
All right, let's see. Let's see if Martine from Brooklyn did a little bit better with this, guys.
Martine from Brooklyn, there's no discussion about holiday songs complete without mentioning Dominic the Donkey. La, 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 it's Dominic the Donkey.
Hey, jingity-jing.
Yaw, yaw.
It's Dominic the Donkey.
Santa's Italian Christmas Donkey, of course.
The Italian Christmas Donkey, la, la.
He didn't sing much either. It's a funny song, Dominic the Donkey.
I heard some backup braying vocals, though, which were pretty impressive, I gotta say.
You should have done that one. All right, we have three wise men now.
I offer you my guilty pleasure Christmas song. And I don't mean any irreverence. I've just always grown up thinking this was funny. We three kings of Orient are tried to smoke a rubber cigar. It was loaded, it exploded. We two kings of Orient are. Well, you get it. Okay.
We had the bleep there.
He had to change the gifts, too, because no one dies from myrrh or frankincense. So, I like it worked out.
Or smokes a rubber cigar anymore. That's kind of an old joke.
That's a three on my scale.
That's a three? I think that's the leader so far. Let's check out Kelly from Memphis, Tennessee now.
This is Kelly Birchfield from Memphis, Tennessee. And my favorite Christmas song is There's Something Stuck Up in the Chimney, and I don't know where it is, but it's been there since last Christmas.
Mark?
I don't like, she was like the little kid voices or singing Cats or anything like that. I generally like someone to sing like it in somewhat of an adult voice. So this is more of a stylistic no.
No.
No problem with the song. Or
had it been
singing,
a singing dog, you would have been a little bit more on board.
I'm going to give her another three. I think it was good effort.
Nobody has gotten above three yet.
Yeah, tough over here in Brooklyn.
Gee, you are tough. Let's see if Eric from Michigan can win Ibrahim's praise.
Hello, my name is Eric Cornell from Waterford, Michigan. My favorite Christmas song is, well, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. There's simply no place to go, so let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
All right, we have to arrive at a consensus here.
Is that Todd Zwillick plugging the bass right there?
That's my favorite right there so far.
Ibrahim, that's your favorite? Does it get above three with you?
It does get above three.
You're not going with Rubber Cigar?
No, I'm going straight with that one. You know why? Because he sang more than just one line.
Mark Harrison. Will give a four to Three Kings because it had a narrative and a little surprise ending.
Are you saying I have to break the tie?
You are the tiebreaker.
You're the man.
As it should be.
I'm going with Three Wise Men and the Rubber Cigar.
Score!
Personally. Sir, get in contact with us. We want to send you a John Hockenberry bobblehead. Please.
And
you deserve it. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. You know, there's always been a stark contrast between the Christmas carol depictions of Bethlehem and the reality. Story of Jesus being born to an unwed mother in a manger 2,000 years ago may be well known, but what about the prospects for children born to unmarried mothers in Bethlehem and the West Bank today? The BBC's religious affairs reporter Christopher Landau joined us from London. He had just returned from visiting a unique children's home in Bethlehem that offers the vulnerable mothers of today's Bethlehem a new start in life. I asked him to set the scene for us.
I visited a place called La Creche, which is in the centre of Bethlehem. It was founded over 100 years ago by a group of Catholic nuns. And over the last 20 years in particular, this indomitable nun, who's now in her 80s, runs a children's home where children who, frankly, would otherwise face a very uncertain future are given a good start in life. And their mothers, meanwhile, are cared for in the last stages of their pregnancy.
What is life like for unwed mothers in Bethlehem and around the West Bank now? What do they face culturally and socially?
Well, it's difficult to overstate the power of what's called the honour code in Palestinian society. And it means that if you do conceive a child and you're not married, your family will ostracise you. And there are even cases of male relatives killing a sister or daughter who has become pregnant because of the shame that that brings on the family. So many of these women get to the creche, sometimes in very secretive circumstances, so that they can spend sometimes the last few weeks of their pregnancy in safety, give birth, and then surrender their child, knowing that they will never see that child again.
Now, you met plenty of people when you visited this center. Let's listen to an American volunteer named Chris from California, who you met, talking about why he decided to work for the center.
I first visited the creche about 2 years ago on a school field trip. I really loved it, fell in love with the kids, fell in love with what they do here. So,
and you've got a real fan there.
Oh yeah, we're buddies. Ehab is deaf. It's a silent world he lives in, so when he sees somebody he recognizes, he gets pretty excited.
You met Ehab at the center. Who else did you meet there?
Well, another child who springs to mind was called Bahar, who's 2 years old and has Down syndrome. And that means that it's almost impossible for him to be placed with a family. There isn't the adoption system that you or I might recognise in the West Bank. And it means that his prospects in life are really quite bleak, and he will probably be in institutions for the rest of his life, but most of them places that aren't properly equipped to deal with someone with his sort of very special needs.
Are there orphanages around Bethlehem in the West Bank after these children are born to unwed mothers? Do mothers often wind up giving these children up?
There are other opportunities for the women concerned. There are other places where the children can go. But for the very youngest children, some of the children at La Creche are just literally hours old when they begin their lives there. There really aren't other places in the West Bank for them. It's that which makes this place so unique. And it's what makes that ministry in Bethlehem so powerful 2,000 years on from the birth of Bethlehem's most famous resident.
Well, children born to unwed mothers in Bethlehem showing just how difficult life can be for them. Interesting when you compare it to the child, as you said, Christopher Landau, of the world's most famous unwed mother, if not a resident, at least a traveler to Bethlehem herself. The BBC's religious affairs reporter Christopher Landau joined us from London earlier. Hi, it's Todd Zwillick filling in this morning for John and Celeste. Coming up, we finish out our remix series on holiday music with members of the band Twisted Sister. We'll discuss a very metal Christmas, folks, coming up. Twisted Sister's Christmas album in just a few minutes. Now at 47 minutes past the hour, here's Mark Garrison with a look at the headlines.
Thank you, Todd. Parts of Texas are experiencing their first white Christmas in decades. Officials in three states have closed highways. The storm stretches across the Midwest with snow on the ground from Texas up to North Dakota. At least 18 are dead on these slick roads in the region. That's the clear sound of bells after Pope Benedict delivered his annual Christmas Day message. The sound was quite different for a Christmas Eve mass. Worshippers screamed as a woman broke through security and knocked over the Pope. Security tackled her. The Pope was okay and went on to celebrate mass. In his weekly address, President Obama has holiday greetings. The first family is in Hawaii for Christmas. The White House says the president wants to spend his holiday in his birth state quietly. He has no public events scheduled. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Thanks, Mark. Now, when you're sitting around thinking about Twisted Sister, as I know you do, this is probably what you're imagining. Of course, that's a staple of your head-banging joy, but what you might not realize is that Twisted Sister has also recorded Christmas songs, including this one on their album, A Twisted Christmas. All right, you catching the similarities there? Today is the final day in our week-long series, Remixing the Holidays, and we are thrilled to have Dee Snider, lead singer, and J.J. French, founding member of the legendary metal band Twisted Sister, here to talk with us about their Christmas album and their favorite holiday songs. Dee, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Good to be here.
J.J., how you doing, man?
I'm awake.
You're awake. Happy holidays.
It's a good thing.
Happy holidays to both of you. JJ, it was your idea to make a Christmas album, right? Which, now this album came out 5 years ago, and it was a huge hit with a cult following, but it's gotten a lot broader play now. There's a multi-city tour, and you've just played in Vegas.
It was actually 4 years ago. A little over 4 years ago, we were sitting around the studio trying to figure out ways, as Dee has so beautifully put it, to put a nail in our coffin.
The final nail in the coffin of our career. How do we kill this thing?
How do we kill it permanently? So the album kind of came up, and then Dee, when you come up with a project, there's a hook involved. And the hook, Dee, was...
Well, I mean, when Jay simply turned to me and said, what about a Christmas album, A Twisted Christmas? And I just immediately clicked for me and said,
you had
well,
the name from the start, right?
I think it grew from the name on JJ's part. And because I said, you know what? That's just crazy enough to work. And I had had some ideas years earlier about, you know, where's the heavy metal Christmas music? You've got every kind of Christmas music, jazz, folk, Euro disco, pop Christmas, but there's never been any metal Christmas music. And I had already had some ideas, and it sort of grew from there.
All right. Well, you guys were both kind enough to share with us a big list of your favorite holiday songs, and we've had an awesome time sifting through them. Dee, your list included this classic number by Judy Garland.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Which then, of course, Twisted Sister made into this little number. So, Dee, you didn't do a bad job of getting a hold of Judy Garland's vibe there with a metal sound.
Yeah, I actually prefer the second half of the song, though, when we pay tribute to the Ramones with the ho, 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 let's go section.
Oh, I would have liked that, too, yeah. But
you know what? I mean, so my mother always tells everybody, he was a classically trained countertenor. So
who knew?
So somewhere, and I sang in the church choir for 19 years. So something had to rub off.
A classically trained countertenor, and you still imitate your mother and make her sound like a
Julia Child,
like Julia Child.
I make her sound like everybody's mother.
Long Island. Oh, right. Can I just say, that Hank Garland, I believe, who wrote "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas," sent an email through, which I got, in which he said he loved the version of it. Now,
of course,
he could probably love any version of it, but he loved that version of it.
All right, well, JJ, one of your favorite songs on our list is from Nat King Cole.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
JJ, you and the band reimagine this song this way. So you got an email from the family of Judy Garland that they loved your other song.
No, actually,
song.
The writer of the song.
Yeah. What do you think Nat King Cole would think of this one?
Well, I have to just say, by the way, that version...
Picture a rotisserie.
That version, though, was played in my house as a kid. You know, it's so imprinted in my brain stem that... But what we did when we turned all these songs on their ear was people thought, I think, we were kind of crazy when we first did it.
Yeah.
And yet, the most perfect example, of course, is the fact that D subliminally, and I'll let him tell the story because he tells it so well, you know, that come all you faithful, we're not going to take it. We're essentially one and the same. So
yeah, well, first of all, my son says that's the most threatening version of Chestnuts he's ever heard. You know, it actually sounds like it's a threat.
Chestnuts roasting.
Chestnuts will
be. Yeah, they're gonna get you.
Chestnuts will be roasted whether they want to be or not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it seems I appropriated. About six notes from "Come All You Faithful," for "We're Not Going to Take It," unbeknownst to me.
Public domain.
Many years after the song, I was with a friend. We were talking about songs that had borrowed heavily from other songs. You know, George Harrison's "My Sweet Lord," "She's So Fine," and he goes, "Well, of course, you know that we're not going to take it. So come all you faithful."
Right.
And I like my head like did like a double take. I was like, "What?"
Yeah.
He goes, "Dude, oh come all ye faithful, we're not going to take it."
You didn't even realize how heavily influenced you were.
Again, 19 years in the church choir, you know, something good came of it, other than the awakening.
And how heavily influenced are you by the Canadian sensation Celine Dion? I have to ask. Listen to this.
Boy, God bless us, everyone. The good and the bad, the happy, the sad.
Dee, a lot of people are going to be surprised, and you talk about your head spinning. Mine was spinning when I heard that you're a big fan of Celine Dion?
Well, post her recording my Christmas song that I wrote for my wife. Yeah, I my wife many years ago said, you know, asked me to write her a Christmas song, which I looked at her and said, are you insane? I'm a headbanger. I don't write Christmas songs. She said, you're a classically trained countertenor. She talks a lot like
Julia
my mother.
Child again.
She sounds a lot like your mom.
And she said, you can do it. And I said, yeah, sure. And all of a sudden, I got this crazy idea. Wrote her a song, had session musicians record it as a Christmas gift for her. One of the engineers went on to become a very big producer named Rick Wake, and years later he called me and said, guess what? Celine Dion wants to record the Christmas song you wrote for Suzette. I said, does she know who wrote the song? He said, no, she doesn't. I said, well, don't tell her.
Don't tell
Satan
her,
wrote her Christmas
it.
Song.
Okay, so you guys got to have Celine Dion out to Vegas and join you on stage at the Hilton Hotel for Twisted Christmas, and you can perform it together. That's my advice to you.
That would be a beautiful moment, I think, if only.
That is my advice to you. All right, JJ and D, you guys have been great. Your Christmas album's great. Good luck with the show in Vegas, and thanks so much for being with us today. We want to take us out. We want you to take us out on Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Twisted Sister. Everybody here at The Takeaway would like to wish you and your family a very happy and healthy Christmas Day. As we sign off, we'd like to share an email that we received this morning from someone celebrating this Christmas overseas, away from his family. First Lieutenant Alexander T. Stefanovich, who is serving in Iraq, wrote this. I would like to take a moment to reflect for you and perhaps the listeners back home the overall mood in Iraq from my point of view at least. I can tell you truthfully that the soldiers that I am currently serving with have a high sense of morale this morning, although the majority of us here are without our loved ones. Lieutenant Stefanovich goes on to say, I leave you with this parting message. To my fellow Americans back home, please keep all U.S. service members and contractors in your prayers over this holiday season, because everyone here is trying to create a new world for those that are less fortunate than us. 'Tis the season for giving, and I plan on giving a heartfelt effort in assisting Iraq in its development as a country capable of so many great things. God bless you all. And God bless the United States of America. I was just reading you an email sent to us this morning from Iraq from First Lieutenant Alexander T. Stefanovich. Thank you for writing to us this morning, First Lieutenant. You and all the troops are in our thoughts this morning. And this is something that I think you should download today, our special edition of the show from Christmas 1941. This is The Takeaway as broadcast on Christmas Day 1941. We dipped into the archives to hear how Americans were feeling just weeks after Pearl Harbor, when we were suddenly a nation at war. This is a great broadcast our producers put together, Jim Colgan and the other producers here at The Takeaway. Go to thetakeaway.org to download it for yourself and hear it all. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Merry Christmas.
Gather near to us once more. Through the years we all will be together. If the fates allow.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.